On the way to our live radio broadcast about Mahler's Ninth Symphony with the conductor Ben Zander, we're revisiting a show we did with Mr. Zander on The Connection about Stravinsky's masterpiece, The Rite of Spring. This conversation was recorded in April 2000.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. These are the augurs of spring at the start of Igor Stravinsky's now famous and familiar, yet nonetheless controversial ballet, The Rite of Spring. It was the very definition of exotic modernism when it premiered in Paris in 1913. The Russian impresario Sergei Diaghilev of the Ballet Russe had commissioned Stravinsky's music. He'd also enlisted Vladimir Nijinsky to do the choreography and Pierre Monteur to conduct the orchestra. Alongside Picasso's Cubism and Gertrude Stein's prose, this Rite of Spring marked one of the defining moments of 20th century modernist experience. The first performance provoked yelling, in fact, fist fights from rival sides of the concert hall. Everything about the piece was disputed, its sounds, its tempo, its choreography, and inside it, the very idea of the whole drama in which a young virgin dances herself to death as a sacrifice to the sun god to mark the rebirth of spring. Today, The Rite of Spring is still controversial, not least because our guest, the conductor Ben Zander, says that The Rite of Spring must never become a safe or antiseptic listening experience. Ben Zander conducts the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra, and he is stirring up the music world again by restoring The Rite of Spring to its original fast tempos. Connection listeners, we're talking this hour about Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, its right performance, if there is such a thing, and the meaning of it all. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome back to The Connection. Ben Zander, tell us just what we're listening to.
Well, this is the August of spring, not actually a tremendously controversial moment, but let's turn for a moment to something that is controversial. That would be the final Danse Sacrale. 10 years ago, we did a performance of the Rite of Spring, and what we did at that time was to restore what we believed to be the original intention of Stravinsky in the tempo of the Danse Sacrale. You described it so well. It was a young virgin who is chosen to dance herself as a sacrifice to death, and the tempo which Stravinsky had played it and many others afterwards, in fact everybody afterwards, was much slower than that appeared on a piano roll that he himself had put together, not played, but put together in 1921, which was much faster, so much faster that it seemed unthinkable to play. And as you said yourself, probably at that time it was extremely difficult to conduct and impossible for them to play, so my theory is that he probably modified the tempo somewhat in order to make it manageable. Let's listen to this. This is the end of The Rite of Spring in 1940, by which time it had already become very familiar with Stravinsky conducting.
Presumably doing it his way.
Right.
But we're not so sure.
Right. That's what we're going to explore.
He's conducting an orchestra in 1940. Okay. The Danse Sacrale.
The final section. Now you can see already they're having terrific trouble. This is in the recording studio with a top orchestra, and they really can't keep it together at the very slow tempo.
You can hear that better than we can, but you say this is an orchestra struggling.
Yeah.
How do you know?
Even at the, because they're not together. People are coming in wrong. Listen.
Mm-hmm.
uncomfortable. Now, listen to the piano roll, which he made at that time in 1921, when he, of course, wasn't constricted by the limitations of the instrumentalist and his own conducting
ability. Is this
ability.
The man himself, his own fingers on the piano?
Not his own fingers on the piano, but he punched it out and supervised it. So, and he made this piano roll in order to get the tempi that he wanted and that he intended so that people wouldn't distort his interpretation. Much faster and
how much faster, Ben?
Driven 30 points on the metronome, quite a considerable number. Now, 10 years ago, when we performed it for the first time, we did it at this tempo, and this is what it sounds like in the Boston Philharmonic performance from 1990. Imagine her dancing herself to death with this tempo. There's no way out for her. Whereas the other way, she might hardly break a sweat.
Let it build. Fascinating to me here is, go ahead, sorry.
That's the end. Yes, sorry.
Well, to go back, what's fascinating is how bad Stravinsky's orchestra was.
Yes, and you should have heard the performance that he did in 1929, the recording there, which was complete pandemonium. I mean, they couldn't, the timpani player got out at the slow tempo and never got back in. So this was music of incredible difficulty and complexity. Nothing like it had ever been written, or no such demands had ever been made on orchestra players. Now it's familiar to us, and even youth orchestras can play this music, although it's still always a challenge, but still it's become easy. Now, you might say, but wait a minute, a piano roll is a mechanical instrument. Surely the conductor himself is a better guide. Well, we have another document that is an extraordinary insight, which is that Monteur, Pierre Monteur, the great French conductor who did the first performance of The Rite of Spring, which you describe so powerfully as having caused a riot, in his recording from 1929, he is clearly going for that very fast tempo, not achieving it, mind you, because they're still finding it chaotic and difficult, but nevertheless it's clear that Monteur is striving for that very fast, very driving tempo, suggesting the Virgin dancing herself to death. This is Monteur. Still enormously chaotic and not together, but very exciting and suggesting. And towards the end, he gets faster and faster and faster.
Wow, you know, implicitly here, and I didn't know we'd end up talking about this, but there's a huge case to be made here for modern recordings, for the modern miking of orchestras,
yes.
Modern understanding, as well as the kind of ease that comes with almost 100 years of familiarity with the sound of this music. But the modern recordings, the old recordings, Pierre Monteur's too, that's not the experience of listening to The Rite of Spring.
On the other hand, there's a downside here, not necessarily compared to those recordings, but in the modern, very plush acoustics and with the great ease and facile mastery that modern orchestras have with this music, we've often lost the raw, primitive, galvanizing horror and frenzy of this music simply because it's become too easy. That's another side of music, that one has to remember what this music was really about for the people who experienced it. We had that discussion.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument. But I wonder, Ben, just listening, if the people in Paris in 1913 could possibly have heard, I mean, with a brand new piece, with the players in doubt about it, with Nijinsky apparently offstage beating out the time to sort of, when the noise of the hall overwhelmed the noise on the stage, Nijinsky apparently was pounding out the rhythm for his dancers.
Right.
Could anybody really have known what that piece was supposed to be about?
Well, they certainly sensed that something extraordinary was afoot. There was something revolutionary in the air, and they knew that this was not something that had ever been heard before. That much, I think, we can be sure. What I think is fascinating is what happened next, because when I did this performance 10 years ago, I thought that was it, and certainly it was received at the time as an enormously revolutionary interpretation, and in fact was chosen on the New York Times as one of the 10 best musical
events. It's my favorite Rider Spring recording, for what that's worth.
Right, well, now let's look again, because normally you think, oh, well, we've done that, and we usually, of course, follow the composer religiously. But recently there was an article which I came across, which was brought to my attention by one of my players, by a professor, Robert Fink, who's in Los Angeles. And he wrote an article in the Journal of the American Musicological Society, which is absolutely fascinating. And he pointed out that I didn't look deeply enough at the time at these issues, that I simply took the fast tempo for the dance sacrale. But what about all the other differences in the early performances and in the piano roll from the way it's become? And he showed in a most convincing and exciting way that there are two kinds of interpretation that have come up, one of which he calls the vitalistic interpretation, the romantic, powerful, rebellious interpretation, the other the geometric interpretation, which is this unyielding metronomic interpretation, which Stravinsky himself came to favor. And as he moved more and more towards the later in his life, he veered more and more towards that diametric and geometric approach and disowned the original vitalistic, powerful, expressive, and strenuous kind of way of playing that is at the essence of this music and of the dance. He rejected the ballet notion. He said, this is a concert piece. It's an abstract piece of musico-spatial geometry, he said.
The ballet world, incidentally, has shunned the piece in general, has it not? I mean, Balanchine didn't want to stage this.
However, it has been reconstructed by a scholar, reconstructing exactly what it must have been like in 1913. But the only thing that is missing, as Professor Fink points out, is that the music used is a modern, very sanitized performance which doesn't fit the original conception at all. What we are doing now is attempting to go back to the original conception of Monteux and of the piano roll and of the early interpreters and try and bring to life again the living, breathing, dramatic experience that The Rite of Spring was intended to be in May 29, 1913.
Have you queued up a recording that would let us hear exactly what you're talking about or not?
Well, let me give you an example. Here's Stravinsky from 1960, by which time his approach had been firmly established, and he'd stamped out any trace of vitalism in the performance, so that now it was becoming unyieldingly metronomic, rather fast, fleet, light, and athletic in its virtuosity. That would be the Stravinsky 1960 Augurs of Spring. You'll just hear the opening of it. Now, listen to the piano roll of 1921 at the same passage. Much faster, harsher, more primitive, more galvanizing. Now those same notes played in the Boston Philharmonic performance from 10 years ago. Thank you. Now, that's a very simple case of simply, he simply speeded it up and lightened it and made it more like a modernist abstraction. What I think he had originally in his mind was something much more seismic, much more powerful. It was, after all, a crushing strain that the music was meant to evoke, and it was an enactment, after all, of a ritual human sacrifice. Mm. And this was music that was conceived at a time when, after all, Europe was on the brink of war, 1914, the world was in turmoil, and it seems that the character of Diaghilev and of Nijinsky, of this massive egotism, the force of danger, the whole Russian folk mode, was much more true to the spirit of the Rite of Spring as it was originally conceived. Mm. What it's become for Stravinsky, became for Stravinsky, was something quite different, a sonic document of unyielding metronomic precision. And he gave no permission to the performer to take any liberty with the tempo whatsoever, and no effects of any kind, and he despised any performance which did that. Bernstein, for instance, was from that tradition. He despised Bernstein's performance. But when we now know that Monteux and Stokowski and Koussevitzky and all these people, who were, after all, romantic musicians, came at this music at first and created something quite different than what Stravinsky had in mind. And he disassociated himself completely from Nijinsky and from Diaghilev and went on a completely different path, away from the romantics. And he had an enormous effect on modern interpretation. In fact, right down to the modern interpretations of Beethoven.
And did he disown the modernist as well as, I mean, this is about spring, this is about a young girl, this is about
but it's not a charming young girl.
No, but it's about the world coming chaotically to life.
Right, exactly.
Did he disown those more sort of primal and revolutionary implications of the whole?
He did. He did, in fact. He said it didn't mean anything. We weren't supposed to look for meanings. I had some wonderful quotations from him about what he said about that. But of course, at the time in 1913, he wasn't a kind of musical oracle that he became, and he may have wanted that brisk, rigid performance then, but he couldn't get it. People changed his music. Monteux actually crossed out his metronome marks and did whatever he felt like in direct contradiction to Stravinsky's wishes. So it became in his hands a late 20th century text, leading the way for modernism in all that means. And he lost sight of, in the process, the experience of the 1913 terror. And that's what I think is a huge loss. That sanitized performance is not at all what I think was originally conceived.
Ben Zander's performance of The Rite of Spring puts the frenzy back in and into the whole conception of what this piece means. What does it mean, Connection listeners? What does it mean to you? 1-800-423-8255. The Rite of Spring Connection with the maestro Ben Zander. Jim is on the line.
Yes, sir. My interpretation of The Rite of Spring has always been almost as a premonition as to, you know, what was coming up in the 20th century. You know, you said turmoil, and that's it for me. I know, you know, you're saying no meaning in it, but...
No, that's what Stravinsky said. That's not what I'm saying. Far from it. I think it was one of the most powerfully expressive pieces of music ever created.
Yeah.
But in Stravinsky's mind, as he got further and further away from the original conception and became a neoclassicist and became attached to a whole different way of thinking and aesthetic, he rejected that interpretation. Now, I'm with you completely.
Amen. I'm a fanatic. I love The Rite of Spring. I've been through the score dozens of times. I go to see it whenever I can, and...
What's your favorite recording, Jim, if I could start a fight here?
Ooh, Michael Tilson Thompson, I think, if I get the name right.
Thomas, yes.
Yeah, thank you. I have like two or three of them, a couple of
That's
them.
That's all?
Yeah, I got to pick up some more.
Jim, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. 8255. Ken is listening online in Hong Kong. Welcome, Ken.
Wow.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm interested more in this whole process of reinterpretation or interpretation of a composer's intentions, more so now than the meaning or how I would interpret the Rite of Spring. And I find it interesting that music has often been too difficult for musicians at the time it was written. This was, the fate of, say, Copland's Third Symphony, which still hasn't really found its way into the repertoire very well. And also the connection with player piano with somebody like Conlon Nancarrow, who, because musicians were incapable of playing his music, resorted almost exclusively to writing for the player piano, and still to this day does do that. But I was wondering if you could comment on maybe some other pieces by Stravinsky or other composers that we know of, or maybe pieces that haven't made their way into the repertoire because they've been difficult or too difficult for musicians when they've been written. Some things that might need a champion now, say even something like Copland's Third Symphony or other pieces.
There are very few pieces actually nowadays that can't be mastered by even the best music students at the conservatories. I mean, pieces that used to be almost unbelievably challenging, like with my youth orchestra is doing Mahler Ninth right now. Mm-hmm. And I remember we did Bartok Concerto for Orchestra with a group of children 12 to 18. And I remember Eugene Lehner, the great old man, he said, when we used to play this, he said, it was so difficult for us. Now our grandchildren can play it. Mm-hmm. So I think the mastery of instrumentalists and musicians generally has become so awe-inspiring.
Is that an ear thing or a chops thing?
It's both, I think. It's partly what we're familiar with. It's partly what we're challenged with. I think the training is better. I think we're just used to it. And I'm sometimes stunned by the complexity of the music that can be mastered by our young professionals now. Carter string quartets and pieces of such monumental difficulty. It's not. And I remember when the Harbison Quintet was a tremendous challenge for the local. You remember the quintet at Emmanuel, and they worked, 80 rehearsals or whatever it was, and they were all the best players, and now the students at the conservatory can play it. So people catch up very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting about this piano roll thing is that composers over the years have tried to find mechanical ways to establish how their music should be played. Beethoven, of course, with the metronome, and now Stravinsky very specifically with the piano roll. What's so interesting about this example with Stravinsky is that he himself went in a different direction from his own original conception, at least it seems that way. And so we cannot turn to Stravinsky himself for instructions on how to do his piece if this division that Professor Fink describes is a true one, namely that the vitalistic, emotional, energetic, living, breathing way of playing Stravinsky's music is stamped out by the composer himself. Mm. It's fascinating.
Ken, do you want a last word?
Well, yeah, I agree completely with the incredible level of musicianship that's out there now. So then that really sort of begs the question as to why we don't hear pieces like Copland's Third Symphony played more often.
Well, no, I don't think that's because it's too difficult. It isn't too difficult.
That's my point.
No,
it's not
not at all. I think it's just, I think it is a great work. It's not a work that has caught the imagination of the general public yet. Although the Fanfare for the Common Man is one of the most popular pieces of music in the entire world. So it may be just a question of time. And as my father used to say, when we would make rude remarks about works of art when we were children, he would say, when a book and a head collide and it sounds hollow, it isn't under all circumstances the fault of the book.
Great. Thank you.
Ken, have a great day in Hong Kong. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Rite of Spring connection with Ben Zander. Chris is calling from his car.
Good afternoon, Chris. How are you?
Good.
Morning still. I used to play in orchestras a few years ago and have since turned to playing pre-recorded music in rock clubs. And listening to that recording of Rite of Spring makes me wonder why I'm not playing it somewhere between Rob Zombie and Korn and Nine Inch Nails.
Right.
I mean,
right. That
bass drum hit going in almost blew my speakers out in the back. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of kids these days are missing the power of classical music, and this would draw some of them in. I mean,
yeah. You're absolutely right. Well, when we play this music, as we're going to do this weekend in Jordan Hall and in Sanders Theatre, which are small halls with 1,000 seats, the impact of the music on the listener is almost like a body blow. It's a visceral experience that has an actual effect on the physical state of the person listening. It is a terrifying experience. And the bass drum, you're right, is just an overwhelming blow. And I'm very much with you on this. I think young people, if they hear this music, will find their heavy metal quite tame by comparison.
Chris, thank you. We're going to go into the break with the glorification of the Chosen One section.
This is where the young girl is chosen to be the one who is sacrificed, and the other people are mocking her and pointing their finger at her because she's just about to die.
We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Rite of Spring connection, though this music is not it. Is not the Rite of Spring, and it wasn't written by Stravinsky either, but there is a connection. We're talking about Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, first performed in 1913, a defining moment in 20th century thinking and feeling and listening. Ben Zander is performing it this weekend in Boston, his own way. What's the connection, Ben, with this music?
Well, we are beginning the program with the Debussy L'Après-Midi. The scandal that you describe on the 29th of May, 1913, was preceded by another scandal on the 29th of May the previous year. That was the first time that the Ballet Russe performed the L'Après-Midi with Nijinsky as choreographer and also as the faun, as the central character, a wild creature, and the Roman deity who falls in love with a wood nymph. And famously, there was a collective gasp at the end of the performance when, as it is described, he descended, hips undulating over the nymph's scarf and quivered in simulated orgasm. Mm. Something from which Paris did not recover for quite a while. And in fact, the Le Figaro cancelled the review and printed instead on the front page, when was the time that an art event was reported on the front page, the editor wrote, "We are shown a lecherous faun whose movements are filthy and bestial in their eroticism and whose gestures are as crude as they are indecent." Now, this event set Paris up for another scandal the following year. So when The Rite of Spring was first performed, in fact, I think the audience and everybody was waiting for another scandal. It had been set up by this event.
Can you top this, Igor Stravinsky?
Right. And here's another thing which is fascinating. The most shocked person of all was Stravinsky himself. He was very prudish, and he disliked intensely the homosexual world of Diaghilev and Nijinsky and the Nietzschean creatures that they were. They represented a force of danger for him. So in fact, that conflict which I'm describing and which Robert Fink describes between these two ways of making music was already built in to the relationship between these two powerful figures, Diaghilev, Nijinsky on one side, representing Nietzsche and the force of danger, and Stravinsky, who was the forerunner of abstraction in art. And so there was a huge split in the culture which was built into that night and which was embodied in the riot which took place at the Rite of Spring performance.
So there's a scandal connection with Debussy. Is there a musical connection then?
Well, in fact, Boulez claims that modern music started with this piece, not with the Rite of Spring, that it caused a complete rethinking of music. The way that this music is put together, not anymore in scales and arpeggios and in the way that music had been done up until that time, but where it was done more by atmosphere, by effervescence, by momentary motives that disappear into the stream of consciousness. It's a whole different way of experiencing music. And he feels that that is at the heart of modern music, certainly as much as the Rite of Spring. So it was, in its own quiet way, as revolutionary or possibly even more so.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Rite of Spring connection with Maestro Ben Zander, who's performing it this weekend with his Boston Philharmonic Orchestra. 1-800-423-TALK. Is the phone. Kurt is calling from a cell phone.
Yeah, first I just wanted to thank you for doing a show on this piece. When I first heard it as a teenager many years ago, I was living on a steady diet of things like Led Zeppelin, rock and roll.
Another one.
And just as you were talking about before the break, it completely spun me around and opened up a door which I don't think I ever went back through again. Opened up a whole other world.
Great.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I think this performance, I mean, only the number of people can get into the hall who can get into the hall, but for everybody in that hall, I think it's going to be that kind of experience again. The orchestra, last night's rehearsal, looked more excited than I've seen them in years. I mean, they were sweating and excited about the intensity of this music.
That's great. It strikes me, though, that, this was a long time ago that this piece premiered and caused the sort of controversy that it did. And nothing like it in terms of creating controversy seems to have happened since.
No, I think that's
right. Do you think it's possible at the stage that we're at right now, the relationship of music to the broader society, that such a thing could ever happen again?
It's an interesting question. You know, I think that there was something going on in Paris in 1913 that was much bigger than any art. I mean, to disentangle all those strands from Paris in the early 1900s is like disentangling the religious strands that lead to and from the Holy Land. I mean, it was Russia and America and Italy and Wagner, and it was a hotbed of creativity and Impressionism and Modernism and Expressionism and everything, and then the World War just about to burst. I think almost the musical experience was a symbol of something much bigger, of a world disintegrating, of a whole European history at a crossroads, and the experience and the emotions and the tensions in that hall and at that time have never been replicated.
Kurt?
Seems that way, yeah. Yep.
Did you want a last word?
No, I would tend to agree. I mean, I can look at some of the 60s, next cultural revolution or some of the NEA wars of the past decade,
as kind of a diffused, similar sort of situation, but nothing of this.
Nothing of quite
point
this
intensity. Yeah.
Right.
Kurt, thank you.
And we might take another example, you know, in this vitalist geometric controversy. It's quite interesting to hear the opening of The Rite of Spring played, first of all, by Boulez in his recording, which I think is the epitome of the geometric style, pretty absolute clarity, with every single thing perfectly in its place. And then let's follow it by the much messier, but in my view much more expressive and deeply moving and effective performance of Monteur from 1929. That would be quite a good
juxtaposition. You want to go first? Pierre Boulez recorded in 1947.
No.
What do you mean by geometric, Ben?
Well, everything is precise and perfect, and every instrument is absolutely ideally lined up with every other one. The triplets are perfectly measured. I can just see his hands, you know, in geometric shapes, conducting it so that everything is perfectly lined up. Also, listen to the sound of that bassoon, so sweet, so pretty, you know, that Stravinsky himself wanted a bassoon that sounded more strained, more like the breaking of the Russian spring out of the ghastly winter. Listen to Monteur from 1929, and you'll see such a different style, full of atmosphere.
Yeah, let's start it again with Pierre Monteur, almost 20 years before.
And evoking memories of a primordial past.
It was raining, obviously, in the recording studio.
Yeah. Stravinsky wrote of this that it described the awakening of nature, the scratching, gnawing, wiggling of birds and beasts. And you hear that in his free, imaginative, slightly rhapsodic, more traditionally romantic way of playing the music. Nothing sanitized about that.
1-800-423-8255. We're re-listening to The Many Rites of Spring with the maestro Ben Zander. 1-800-423-TALK. Leah is on the line.
Good morning, Chris. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Leah.
It's Rochelle's mother.
Oh, yes.
Hi.
A great musician, her daughter is a great
yes,
musician.
Yes, thank you. And
a great lady, her mother. Right.
My goodness, I'm not sure we can go on this way. Ben, I wanted to ask you a question about the musicianship of especially today's wonderful young musicians, who indeed have a level of technical competence at a very early age that far exceeds often the technical competence of mature musicians of a somewhat earlier time. Do you think that the great emphasis on technical virtuosity, which now characterizes the training of young musicians, has caused a loss of some other aspects of their training? Not always, but all too often, I go to a concert, particularly of a young soloist who has recently won a competition. I am overcome by the level of virtuosity, but walk out wondering what was the point.
Right. Well, of course, this is exactly at the heart of the matter. This is precisely what has been lost. When you listen to those two performances that we just heard, you've got one which is obsessed about clarity, precision, exactness, and the other about the atmosphere of spring. And That is something that we are not training our young musicians to be not only aware of, but obsessed by.
Yes.
And
how would you do it? And how did the earlier generation get trained to think spring, not just chops?
Well, in the old days, I mean, I can't say you can't be categorical about it, but in general, the great teachers of the past, the Schnabels and the people of that nature, were absolutely deeply engaged in music as an expressive language, and all the great conductors from that time, whether it was Klemperer or it was Furtwängler or it was Beecham or whoever, Bruno Walter, these people had very little truck with the kind of precision that we're talking about that is elevated to a status of glory in our age. And I think one of the great enemies here is the CD itself. I think people are so used to hearing very precise performances. In those days, after all, there were only live performances, and in live performances people could take risks and play with a kind of fervor and a kind of vitality and daring that unfortunately is very rarely found anymore. And I'm trying my best to restore it by running around the world and encouraging people to take risks and to play out. Schnabel said, safety last. I love that.
Leah, did you want to follow up?
Yes, I just wanted to say my late father-in-law, who was a magnificent amateur cellist and often played with some of the greatest musicians in Europe of his time, did not own any records or record player. And I was rather scornful of him at the time. I heard him say, "No, I don't listen to records. I guess I am a troglodyte." And I thought, indeed, you are a troglodyte. But I think he was on to the same kind of thing that Ben's on to.
But you know, it's also, I wouldn't go that far.
I
was listening to, you know, how amazing that one can sit in one's home in Cambridge and listen to Monteux performing in Paris in 1929, and what a privilege that is, and how much we learn from, otherwise how would we know how these people thought of this music? And no, I think this is our history, and I love to delve into it.
Leah, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Rite of Spring connection. Jan is calling from Newton Junction, New Hampshire.
Hi, Ben. It's Jan, your oboe coach for YPO.
Oh, wonderful.
And
YPO, everybody should know, is the Youth Philharmonic Orchestra, who are currently working on Mahler 9th for performance in June. Amazing.
Well, what I think is that nobody over 30 ought to be allowed to perform this piece.
Mm-hmm.
They can conduct them, but they can't perform it. Yeah. I think when the kids play it, it puts an energy and maybe some of that terror you were talking about for the first time. I think I was 22 when I played it the first time, and it was very terrifying.
Right.
And how many times can you be terrified, I guess?
Right. Jan, I absolutely agree. This is the piece about the stored up energies of spring about to burst. It's the life force itself. It's the urges of adolescent energy. It's about joy and elation. It's about getting to the limit of human experience. It often gets to the point of being unbearable. And when we get older, we defend ourselves against those experiences. And that's why the idea of a young virgin who is elected in an orgiastic dance to sacrifice herself to spring, that is the life force against the force of death, convention, of conforming to the status quo. It is the very force of imagination itself.
Mm.
But I think it's not something that should be kept from adults and older people. I think we should remind them of it as often as possible.
Absolutely.
And in performances that are as raw and as driven and as exciting and as full of living, breathing, dramatic experience as they possibly can be.
Jan, I want to ask Ben. Ben is a believer, a big believer in transformative music. We should be different people coming out than we were going into the concert hall.
Absolutely.
What should be on the minds, on the faces, in the hearts of people coming out of a great Rite of Spring?
Well, you know, one of the members of the orchestra, our wonderful oboist, Alison Doane, said to me, "What is the right response after this piece?" Because after the rehearsal the other day, when I first described this new way of doing the piece, people looked quite wan and white-faced and shaken. by the experience, and it was not at all a feeling of triumph. It was a kind of a horror, a sense of having been taken to the edge and looking out over the abyss. So I think it may well be that people will be dumbstruck by it rather than the elation of great, you know, terrific triumph. So that each individual person will experience for themselves. One thing I can guarantee, they will not be untouched, unmoved, and unchanged.
1-800-423-8255. The Rite of Spring connection with Ben Zander. Erwin is on the line.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be able to be on this wonderful station. Congratulations, Chris and Ben Zander.
Thank you, Erwin.
I'm a concert goer. And, Ben, I'm looking forward to your performance on Sunday in Cambridge.
Wear your seatbelt.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I was interested in your remark about the piece being taking us back to the primordial past.
Right.
Because I think I go back a little farther, maybe not as far as the primordial past, but I was exposed to this wonderful piece when I saw Walt Disney's Fantasia.
Right.
In 1941 in Connecticut, where we lived at that time. And the conductor was Paul Dukas. The choreography.
No, the conductor was Stokowski, I believe.
Well, I think Dukas did some of it at the maybe the outset.
No,
I think Dukas
Paul Dukas
did the Mickey Mouse one.
Yeah, that's Dukas.
That's right.
Yeah, he's the composer.
That's right.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Exactly.
Right.
So. And it was just a remarkable thing, and I was really hooked when I first heard that, and have been so forever. And I actually went and bought the video of Fantasia so I could show my grandchildren and have them hear some of the great music that this piece evokes.
I think, however, if I may say so, that the conception and the realization in 1913 in Paris was a very far cry from Walt Disney.
Oh,
I think it was a really terrifying experience, and I think that it was somewhat mollified in the version in Fantasia, and I think to go back to the original feeling of the piece is a quite a different thing.
Erwin, thank you. Any quick composer's tips on how you do, conductor's tips on exactly how you do that? How you get the terror, the deep darkness in this piece back, the destruction as well as the creation, the fear, as somebody wrote, of what may be born.
Yeah. Well, listen to this. Listen to this music. This is the sacrificial dance itself, and those terrifying ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, and this, like, screaming, listen to that screaming sound of the violins. You keep the emotions close to the edge. You imagine what it would be like to be caught in the grip of this dance, of somebody literally dancing herself to death in a frenzy of rhythmic intensity. And you keep the rhythms taut, and you keep the dynamics powerful, and you never forget how strange, how wonderful, how unbearable it is.
Ben Zander, thank you again for joining us on The Connection. Connection listeners, if you're anywhere near Boston this weekend, Ben Zander and the Boston Philharmonic will be performing The Rite of Spring Saturday at Jordan Hall, Sunday afternoon at Sanders Theater. Thanks for help today from John Hoder, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.